You are. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Half a century ago, William F. Buckley Jr. blazed into American letters as a conservative revolutionary. Today, at 76, he looks out on a world where, in vast swaths of American life, conservatives have won. But does he like what he sees in this hour, the wit and wisdom of William F. Buckley, the man behind the movement? We begin tonight with news that all is not quiet on the Eastern Front. Indian and Pakistani forces traded heavy fire across their border today, again raising fears the two nuclear neighbors could be sliding toward war. Diana Coulter is with the Christian Science Monitor in New Delhi. Earlier, I asked her what was driving tensions higher.
Since the attack last Tuesday by terrorists that were interested in independent, perhaps, for the Kashmir region here in India, tension has been increasing. I'd say even the searing heat wave afflicting northern India is being outstripped by the intense political heat being put on the government to retaliate forcefully against Pakistan for what India believes is its role in funding terrorist activities in Kashmir.
So Indians are outraged by the terror and they're being driven a little bit crazy by the heat wave. How much force readiness is there on both sides?
There's an estimated 1 million troops massed on the border between India and Pakistan. Since the terrorist attack last week, they've been trading fire in the disputed Kashmir area, and about 12 people have been killed, about 70 wounded on both sides, and some say hundreds, maybe even thousands of civilians have been displaced in the border areas by the firing and shelling.
The stock markets in both countries have taken a hammering as a result of fear of war, I guess.
Yes, that's right. Certainly many in the military seem very anxious here for retribution. They took the latest terrorist attack more personally, since it did happen on an army base in the Kashmir area and killed soldiers' wives and children. So the military chiefs have refused to rule out war. Some are calling for surgical strikes. Other observers are calling that option foolish, seeing as you cannot, of course, predict the Pakistani response. And we're talking about two nuclear-armed countries here.
The United States is deeply involved in this region right now with military and operations in Pakistan. And Assistant Secretary of State Christina Rocha, I guess, has been in Delhi and Islamabad for her third visit in just as many months. What are the stakes for the United States in this? What role is it playing?
It would appear that the U.S. is still having a calming influence here. They've been urging more time for Pakistan to crack down on the terrorists in their region. And certainly, since last January, Pakistan has arrested close to 2,000 suspected terrorists. Mind you, some have been released since. And many Indians are impatient with the U.S. They say that they can't define and deal with terrorism differently east of Pakistan than west of Pakistan.
That is, that New Delhi should be allowed to go after terrorists with the same vigor that Washington has.
That's correct.
Is there any alternative to full-scale war to going after these terrorists?
So far, India's Prime Minister Vajpayee is mulling over what he calls an appropriate response to this latest terrorist attack. He's been seeking a consensus with government and opposition members, and so far has sent the Pakistani envoy home from Delhi. And this week is going to Kashmir to survey the scene and hopefully come up with some solution that might appease people here.
What leverage does Washington have to hold India back from its urge to war?
Certainly, there is joint military action happening between the U.S. and India right now. There was recently a training exercise held outside of Agra, near the Taj Mahal, between U.S. and Indian forces, and they've long had a partnership in that vein. India just likes to view itself and has typically been fairly rational in its dealings with other countries in Pakistan, and responds to calls for continuing in that vein.
You've reported that some serious observers of these two countries say that India is less likely to go to war with Pakistan because it's not clear what that war could accomplish.
Well, both countries are nuclear-armed states. it's all very well to say, well, we'll just send a few token shells across the border and hope that Pakistan responds in a similarly conservative fashion. But Pakistan in the past has said that it's prepared to use all its resources, including its nuclear capabilities, to defend its territory.
Diana Coulter is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from New Delhi. By 30, William F. Buckley Jr. had founded the conservative magazine National Review. By 40, he had his own whip-cracking television show, Firing Line, which would run for 1,429 broadcasts. Today at 76, he's the author of 41 books, including 15 novels. He no longer accepts public speaking engagements, but his wit is as sharp as ever. In his weekly columns, he's criticized Cardinal Bernard Law for the church sex scandal, called Prime Minister Sharon's recent military offensive the, quote, stupidest campaign in recent memory, and lobbied for a more measured interpretation of the right to bear arms. In this hour, we're talking with William F. Buckley Jr. about the state and future of American conservatism. What does it mean to be conservative in America today? Are conservatives on the right track? Is the conservatism of George W. Bush's world the conservatism William F. Buckley dreamed of 50 years ago? Or has the great beast changed its course? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from his home in Stamford, Connecticut, is William F. Buckley, Jr. His new novel is Nuremberg, The Reckoning, and he'll read a bit of that before the hour is out. But first, we'll have at it. Good evening and welcome, William F. Buckley.
Hi, nice to talk to you. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being here. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Buckley.
How are you? It's Beatty.
Very good, sir.
Good.
William Buckley, we read of your lifestyle at this age, which you've achieved, and it sounds wonderful. Your friend Chris Weinkopf wrote on Salon.com a couple of years back about how you winter in Switzerland, you write a novel a year, you churn out your 100 columns or so, and have your 8-hour work day, 7 days a week, all 6 weeks you're over there, socialize, and everything's punctual and everything's lovely. How is life in the Buckley world these days?
People wonder that I work as many hours as I do, but most people work the same number of hours. I think it's simply a fiction that when people reach a certain age, they stop working. For one thing, work is gratifying, makes the time pass. So the answer is that I work, you know, as hard as I did years ago, though I no longer have my television station and no longer, thank God, do speaking appearances. But I continue to write books, and I hope you enjoy Nuremberg, The Reckoning.
We'll hear a bit of that later in the hour.
Good.
And we take the point that you no longer minutely follow every twitch of the news, but we're hungry to know what your view of the general trail of conservatism is by your lights these days. I guess I want to ask first, though, how closely in touch you remain with the world of conservative thinkers and politicians. For a long time, you were a huge oar in that world. Are you still engaged?
Oh, the answer is I am engaged, and I'm an editor at large of National Review, and I write my column and I keep track, but what I'm not good at, and I hope you won't press me, is in utter familiarity with twists and turns in Washington, this Senate committee and that congressional committee. But far away and do anything you like, and I'll try not to disappoint you.
All right, we don't expect to be disappointed, and it's really not the small stuff we've come for this evening. I guess it's a bigger view. Way back in the 60s, you called yourself a revolutionary against what was then the prevailing liberal order. Here we are in 2002, and it could be said that conservatism has, in many, many aspects of American society, triumphed. Is this the revolution you dreamed of?
Well, you're using metaphors in an entirely appetizing way. I was a revolutionary in the sense that I was a dissident. If one wants to to take a flamboyant reading of a dissident, then he becomes a revolutionary. It's true that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people who took the line that I presently take and did then tended to be entirely dominant. They still are in the academic world, but you know, the notion that somebody could run for president as Dick Armey did and say he believed in a flat tax would have been thought so entirely bizarre as to be undoable. So in that sense, there has been a movement of opinion in the direction of the centers towards which I organize my own views and that of my magazine.
With respect, William Buckley, that sounds like a grudging assessment of what's happened. I mean, haven't we seen a fairly enormous swing in American politics? Even our last Democratic president, Bill Clinton, was carrying out policies that would have been considered quite conservative in the 60s, and now we've got George Bush surrounded by fire-eating conservatives.
Well, I think you say it accurately when you suggest the relative drama of what has happened. In absolute terms, it's not that dramatic. The percentage of the gross national product being spent by the public sector is slightly greater now than it was 15 or 20 years. Not all that much greater. What has happened, I think, is that the pretensions of scientific socialism have been largely discredited by empirical experience, so that people aren't swayed as easily as they were 30, 40 years ago by the claims of socialism as a model for idealistic political thought. In that sense, I will grant you that there has been an enormous change during those years.
If you can cast your mind back to what you hoped for or anticipated then. If conservatives would take over the White House in a thoroughgoing way, is the Bush administration at all the picture that you had in mind?
Well, I said when he first contended for office that it was correct to say about Mr. Bush that he was conservative, incorrect to say that he was a conservative. A conservative is properly used for somebody whose basic worldview is centered on conservative ideals. One could say that about, say, Ronald Reagan, not, I think, about George Bush. So he is, and I admire him enormously, but he is not a conservative in the sense in which I just described it, but his reactions and impulses are, quote-unquote, conservative.
Revolutions tend to spread out like rivers as they proceed. Do you see that in the conservative movement in the U.S. today? Are there more diverse wings and perspectives on what it means to be conservative today than it was early on?
Well, that always happens. There are those little swirls and eddies that grow out of the principal direction, principal orientation of the movement. We had it 30 years ago with Ayn Rand and the Objectivist School, which was sort of anarchist and still is, and adamantly anti-religious. We had it with the John Birch Society, which insisted on explaining all developments in foreign policy on the assumption that people who directed that foreign policy were working for the other side. Though those have been absorbed and thrown off, those boarding parties continue, so that there will always be kind of a tuning fork involved in which, and this is true, of course, not only of the Republicans but of the Democrats, in which efforts are made at a continuous excretion of attachments which are not only strategically harmful, but also tend to contaminate the wholesomeness of the political thought.
We're going to talk about that contamination. Jack Beatty, hold your fire. We'll bring you in after the break. We're talking with William F. Buckley, Jr., founder and editor-at-large of the National Review and author of the new novel, Nuremberg, The Reckoning. He'll read from that at the end of this hour. Listeners, what does American conservatism stand for today to you? Is the Bush administration the full flowering of American conservatism? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with William F. Buckley, Jr. about American conservatism. What's your question for Mr. Conservative, William F. Buckley? What does American conservatism stand for today? And has conservatism won, hands down? And if so, for how long? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William Buckley, our friend Gerard Baker at the Financial Times wrote recently that in spite of all their victories in Washington, and he writes that Washington is now arguably, or more than arguably, the most conservative of the major industrial governments in the world by a fair ways, that in spite of all the progress they've made and everything the Bush administration has achieved in its rejection of international treaties, in its pursuit of tax cuts, in its support of the right of citizens to bear arms, that conservatives are in an awfully grumpy, angry mood. Have you perceived that, and why is that?
Yeah, you see that in part because people who are conservative tend to reach out towards a kind of a paradigm, a model, and to the extent that they don't reach it entirely, they are dissatisfied. This could be true. This could be said equally of the left, both European and American. When in 1945 the British elected the socialists as governor, there was continuous dissatisfaction in the next two or three years on the grounds that Clement Attlee wasn't going far enough.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, many conservatives feel that Mr. Bush and Congress aren't going far enough, and I agree with them. But my rule has always been that you should measure the performance of a friendly administration both by its proximity to the ideal and by the extent to which it struggles to move in that direction, because unless one is political realistic, one becomes simply irrelevant. Certain things that I'm sure Mr. Bush would do if he were a plenipotentiary, he doesn't do or even propose.
So I guess that your assessment there is that conservatives like liberals can become permanent revolutionaries, never satisfied. Jack Beattie, I want to get you into this conversation. We want to talk more about exactly what is far enough for conservatives. But join us, Jack. What does William Buckley raise in your mind?
Well, he raises intellectual honesty. Throughout his career, he has stood for that. He mentioned the John Birch Society. His magazine stood up to it and among people who were quite sympathetic to it. In 1992, he wrote a really, I think, a very important expose of the anti-Semitism or near anti-Semitism of Pat Buchanan, which I think played a big role in limiting Mr. Buchanan's appeal. And in 1964, he went before a gathering of the Young Americans for Freedom, which he had helped to start, a group that was besotted with love of Barry Goldwater, and told them, I speak about the impending defeat of Barry Goldwater. And all the sound went out of the room. He went on. He said, our morale is high and we are marching, but it is wrong to assume that we shall overcome. Any election of Barry Goldwater would presume a sea change in American public opinion. He went on to say, so let's look for future recruits, not only for November the 3rd, but for future Novembers, to infuse the conservative spirit in enough people to entitle us to look about us, not at the ashes of defeat, but at the well-planted seeds of hope, which will flower on a great November day in the future.
If there You've got is, a hell of a memory, Mr. Beattie.
Yeah, if there right. is a future. Well, that November day came, didn't it, when your longtime, if not charter, National Review subscriber Ronald Reagan became president.
Yeah, well, that's correct. That is correct.
And the conventional wisdom, of course, about the 60s was and about that election of 1964 was pretty much given by Arthur Schlesinger and Aaron Wildowski, who said, "We can if the Republicans nominated conservative again, he would lose so badly we can expect an end to a competitive two-party system." Mr. Buckley, what happened? How did that revolution take place?
What happened, and I'm not sure you'll disagree with me on this, is that the fires ignited by Goldwater the people to whom he was speaking were people who didn't simply discard what he had to say after the great defeat of November 1964. Their appetites were stimulated to look for people who would try and do it one more time. So it wasn't a defeat of the kind that imposes silence on the defeated party. Rather, it turned out to be a sort of a stimulant. So Arthur Schlesinger and John Kenneth Galbraith were just thunderously wrong when they assumed that the approaches of Mr. Goldwater had been historically repudiated. They were not. They had sort of a show in under Mr. Nixon, but they did, I think, a flower in 1980 under the patronage of Mr. Reagan.
Well, what was it that liberalism became discredited, and how did that happen? How would you, because in 1960...
I think that liberalism implicitly suggested a constant improvement as some correlation of the exercise of our government welfareism. Poverty was to be ended by welfare programs. Illiteracy was to be ended by subventions by the federal government to the schools. Foreign policy was going to be successful as a result of the inherent appeal of anti-communist position. Well, all that stuff kept on going, but it just didn't happen. So the people looked around. They found the crime was still there and, in fact, growing. Illiteracy hadn't changed. People had not climbed up from poverty. And under the circumstances, there was a rejection of the postures of liberalism. I ran for political office, not seriously, but...
Mayor of New York.
Mayor of New York, yeah. And I tested these propositions out and had sort of a full-throated response by a lot of people in Manhattan, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island. And I was convinced by that experience that I was correct in assuming that the defeat of Goldwater the year before was a defeat more properly characterized as a phenomenon than a historical rejection of an idea.
Hmm. And what a phenomenon.
Yeah, of course, we can't say that liberalism was a complete failure.
No, of course not.
Medicare, Medicaid, aid to higher education, the Environmental Acts. We live in a world that sort of takes liberal achievement for granted.
Do you count those as liberal achievements, William Buckley?
Well, if you're saying, have we established that health is an aspect of vigorous government, then I would say, no, we haven't proved that at all. We're now spending about 14% of the GDP on health, and an awful lot of people are dissatisfied. 14 million people aren't insured at all. Education, in my judgment, has not manifestly improved as a result of federal intervention in it. I think that you can say about liberals that they continue to stimulate appetites, which looked for some kind of improvement in the lot of people's lives. But how that improvement was affected, I think, had to do with conservative signals rather than liberal signals.
And is that the rub, then, that it's wrong to raise those expectations? What's the conservative answer to the liberal promise of progress through government action?
Well, the conservative answer is you're doing it not only the wrong way, what you're doing is hurting. By today's standards, in the year 1900, 90% of the American people live below the poverty line. Now, that is now about 13 or 14%. It has kept going in a secular direction towards improvement up until about 20 years ago, and then it kind of stalled. But the improvement in living conditions was not affected by government, as witnessed that the poverty figures have not been influenced by government intervention, so that to the extent that people are reminded that their own effort, their own concern for education Well, preventive health care is the best way to go about an improvement in life, then the conservatives are both relevant and, I think, ultimately rewarded.
William Buckley, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to turn to our callers. Harvey's on the line. Welcome, Harvey. You're on the air.
Hi. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Buckley.
Thank you.
Over my lifetime, you've had a lot of influence on my thought, and I think you've understated how much influence you've had on the society here in general. I think it's pretty well established by a majority of Americans that, to some extent at least, the fiscal conservatism is a part of their thinking. I'd like your current view on the social conservatism, and particularly the religious right and the movement in the last 10 or 15 years as a result of Mr. Falwell and Mr. Robertson, to create a really strong linkage between religious right views and social right views and the conservative movement.
It's a rich subject, Harvey. Let's put it to William Buckley.
I had Falwell on my program 7 or 8 years ago, and at the end of the hour, I said, you know, I can't think of anything you have said that distresses me. And let me point out that if every single recommendation that you have forwarded were enacted, we would have the United States exactly what existed when I was an undergraduate in college. And nobody was then complaining about great inroads by the church against the state. As you may know, Falwell is completely in favor of complete rights for racial minorities. So really, what it seems to come down to in the social issues is homosexuality, by which I mean that Falwell does not deviate from the traditional position that homosexuality is a kind of a biological aberration and ought to be acknowledged as such. This is a very divisive position to take. That and
there is a little matter of abortion.
On abortion, yeah. Mm. Those two are the issues that, as I say, tend to polarize the public hugely, but they as I say they're not recently invented, and they are in my judgment not positions which history will judge as being indefensible. If it's correct that a human being. Life begins in the fetus, then it's correct that human beings' lives should be protected.
But when you say to Jerry Falwell that the world he describes seems to fairly well describe the world of your youth, does that mean that we'd be better off back in that year?
I'm sorry, I missed it. Back in what year?
Well, let's say the years of the youth that you describe.
But it depends what you mean by we would be better off.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Whose life is aborted would certainly be better off because they have no life whatsoever under existing dispensations.
But there were also plenty of people, as you pointed out earlier, working in fairly low wage and miserable conditions then.
Well, if you're saying that the poor will always be with us, I tend to agree. But I don't think that one can defend a licentious abortion on the grounds that it is a step against poverty. Now, let me tell you something which I once wrote a few years ago, and people came down thunderously on me. It is that a lot of people who are in favor of choice are not all that secretly are anti-black. They use the poverty argument precisely. They say, well, a disproportionate majority of blacks get abortions, and since they are disproportionately poor, then by aborting their potential issue, one is fighting to keep the poverty line down. I think it's probably correct, but that doesn't make correct that particular step.
There's the parry and the thrust, but I don't want to necessarily leave that label on pro-abortion folks. But let's get another call. Gene's calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Welcome, Gene. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's quite an honor to speak with you, Mr. Buckley.
How are you?
Very good. Mr. Buckley, I guess my question is, that one place where I feel that that conservatives and liberals has always been in agreement is their concern for protecting themselves from the government with their civil rights. And right now in this climate we're in, it seems like people are not concerned with protecting their civil rights and are somewhat willing to give them up. What a conservative, first of all, do you agree that conservatives and liberals do agree on that? And what do conservatives and liberals do to make sure we don't lose those civil rights at this time?
In a time of war on terror, thanks for your call, Gene.
I'm not sure what civil rights you have in mind, but I will report to you that I had a frenzied telephone call this morning from the publisher of my magazine who said that somebody had come in from the whatever department that is in New York City that says you can't smoke, come into our office to do a random search and found out that four or five people had smoked cigarettes. And he threatened all kinds of draconian reprisals if that were ever detected again. Now, is that a civil right? We would have the liberals, the environmentalists, tending to say, well, we have a superintending view of the health of people under the circumstances. We can properly intervene to keep them from smoking, even in their own quarters.
But would you put that on a par with greater government surveillance of citizens?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would. I think it's part of the same anxiety by government to look in and adjust the shower level.
How about
in that wonderful metaphor,
Jack?
How about government in people's bedrooms? I mean, after all, freedom is what choice is all about. Individualism, my individual right exists. My freedom with my own body exists. How can we defend the government saying no? You don't have the freedom of your body.
That's Mr. Beattie, that question.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I can't hear Mr. Beattie.
Jack, how about giving that again?
Well, I was just pointing out the paradox of, you know, talking about Big Brother, but surely, Mr. Buckley, in abortion, Big Brother looms more intimately than in any other way. I mean, if people on the Supreme Court, whom I think you probably favor, had their way, women would not have this basic right, which is definitive of their freedom.
No, but the perspectives are completely different because the conservatives view that there is more than one human being alive, involved, not just the mother, but the child. We grant that if the baby is one day old and he's killed, then that's an act of infanticide. So the question is, does that baby, when he's less than one day old, also have certain entitlements? It is not a diminution of the mother's rights to acknowledge the rights of the child.
We've got to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with William F. Buckley about the Bush administration, about the Catholic Church. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. What's your question for Mr. Conservative William F. Buckley, Jr.? What does American conservatism stand for today? And I guess, what is the legacy of Buckley generation conservatives? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by William F. Buckley, conservative thinker for many years and author of a new novel, Nuremberg, The Reckoning, which he'll read from a bit for us before the hour's out. But we're talking about a whole smorgasbord of things before we get to that. What's your question for Mr. Conservative William F. Buckley? When did William Buckley first inspire you? When did he first make you really boiling mad? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William Buckley, let me take you through just a few Bush administration actions, just to get your quick response. Steel tariffs.
What was that?
Steel tariffs, recently imposed by the Bush administration on imports of steel.
I think it was a bad mistake, tactical and certainly ideological. Tactical because, in the last analysis, American steel prices can't compete with those we're contending against, and philosophical because it instantly invites people to devise means of their own to retaliate. Now we've had a lot of tariffs for a lot of years. We still have right now, but symbolically, it was, I think, a great capitulation by Mr. Bush, and I deeply regret it.
How about the Farm Bill?
Well, the Farm Bill is a continuing welfare program. If it were fashioned in such a way as to guarantee us strategically against a drought or whatever, that would be one thing. But what it is simply a continuation of a subsidy program for which there is no evident need. Although I do believe in equal treatment, even so, I think we can depart from equal treatment by saying at least we're not going to subsidize farm programs where the farmer is earning more than $125,000 a year. But we didn't have the nerve to say that because there are too many influential farmers in the act to play with that particular game.
And how about tax cuts? I guess tax cuts that favor the top 1% fairly heavily.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm certainly in favor of that because I believe in equal taxes. When you're paying, yeah, well, 1% of the American people are paying 25% of the taxes, 5% are paying 50% of the taxes. Under the circumstances, there is a disproportion there, which I think is philosophically objectionable, but is also, in my judgment, an attack on the profitability of the marginal dollar. And to do that is to restrain the kind of economic exuberance from which over the years and indeed centuries we've profited.
So keep the money in old money hands.
Well, it's not old money hands because, for instance, year before last, 30% of the people who were in the top bracket had risen from the fourth bracket or even the third bracket.
Oh, I misunderstood. I thought it was 90s style exuberance that you were objecting to.
Well, I'm objecting to whatever it was that made you say old money.
Got it.
It's not old money.
Got it. Let's go to Chris. He's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening, Chris. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. And Mr. Buckley, I've long been challenged by your calls, whether I agree with them or not, and I'm glad to hear you're still writing them. Yeah. What I was curious was, do you think that conservative, in the current context, as things are with our constitutional system, without a line item veto and without a balanced budget amendment and so forth, that conservatives are at a disadvantage because the easiest way to deal with what we frequently have between a president of one party and at least one branch of Congress of another, the easiest way to deal with that contention of different budgetary agendas is simply combine them and pass them both, you know, even if it runs over the amount of revenue.
What would you prefer, Chris? Line item? But veto, you're saying?
I guess there's a problem with that. The Supreme Court feels there's a problem with that being constitutional, I guess.
What about the budgetary responsibility of Congress now? And what do you think, I guess, to piggyback on that, of the Bush administration pushing us back into a deficit?
Is that a question?
For you, William Buckley, please.
Yeah, I think the answer is, of course, we are going into a deficit. It's projected out for $100 billion. And we have quickly wiped away the surplus. But this has to be acknowledged as a relative wartime situation. Ask yourself this question: what would the budget look like if we hadn't had the September the 11th? It would have been much less glowing than it was 3 years ago because we've had a business cycle. There's nobody who's predicted that we have learned how to cope with a business cycle in the sense of avoiding it altogether. What we have learned to cope with, as Milton Friedman teaches, is some of the excesses of the business cycle that took us, for instance, into the profound depression of the 30s. But pending that, I think an argument is very, very convincing that would give the chief executive the right to veto particular items that had been appended to a huge bill. I acknowledge the constitutional argument against that, but there have been so many refinements of constitutional thought, many of them legitimate, many of them not, in my judgment, legitimate, that I should think that's not really a powerful, powerful argument. It is, of course, Congress that hugely resists the line item veto for the most obvious reasons.
William Buckley, our time is growing short. We want to get your thoughts on the trials and tribulations of the Catholic Church of late, particularly around the sex scandal in the United States.
My thoughts are that it's a scandal, a pity, and a source of great sorrow. We have to remember the historical perspectives and remember that huge number of sinners do nothing than ultimately then magnify the fact of sin itself. How to treat the sinners becomes in part a clerical responsibility, but also a civil responsibility. It's that direction in which we are headed. I think that the utter abomination of what has been done by members of the clergy is something that will cause people to wince in pain and in sorrow for decades.
You've written that Cardinal Bernard Law should reasonably be regarded as having been incapacitated to lead the American church toward recovery. Does that mean he should resign?
That, in my judgment, he should, yes.
And what will it take to fix the problem?
Well, it will take God may clear his throat and shed light on the subject. I think it should be stressed that the overwhelming number of sins that have been committed of this order have been by by people who ordained priests in the 60s and 70s. There is not a large incidence of anything of the kind by priests who were who were invested from 1980 on. So one likes to think that it is in part a disease that attaches itself to a particular couple of decades, and that under the circumstances, even normal cultural remedies will assert themselves.
Jack Beattie, we've just got a minute left. Your last question or thought?
Well, it's just a pleasure to talk to Mr. Buckley, and he, as an earlier caller said, he has been too modest about his effect on conservatism. In many ways, we live for good and ill in the shadow of Mr. Buckley's work.
I appreciate that. Very kind of you.
In a moment, we'll have William F. Buckley reading from his new novel, Nuremberg, The Reckoning, from an earlier recording today. William Buckley, thank you for joining us this evening.
Nice to talk to you.
Jack, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, and thanks, Mr. Buckley.
We'll be back in just a moment with William F. Buckley reading from Nuremberg, The Reckoning. This is On Point. William F. Buckley, Jr. is the author of 41 books. He's just released his 15th novel. It follows Sebastian, a young German-American whose life becomes intimately intertwined with the events of the Nuremberg war trials. We're going to listen as William F. Buckley reads an excerpt from the novel Nuremberg, The Reckoning. In this passage, Sebastian is serving as an interpreter as the prosecution questions the defendant, Kurt Waldemar Amadeus, an SS commander in charge of overseeing the construction of a new wing at the Dachau concentration camp. The lead attorney in the case has just taken a break when Sebastian takes the lead and asks some questions of his own.
Sebastian left to pursue the interrogation, thought it prudent to strike an informal note. Speaking in German, he started off by saying, "I lived in Hamburg when I was born. I was there until 1939 when my mother took me to America." Amadeus looked sharply at Sebastian and then said, "I know Hamburg. There's not much of it left, I understand." "No, not much. I came through it on the way here. It's like Nuremberg." "Well, the captain wishes me to continue the inquiry." "Go ahead," Amadeus said. "If an arrival was not sent immediately to the death chambers, how long did he continue to work in the workforce?" "That depended. Some workers were specially qualified. For instance, a good electrician, an experienced carpenter. Does that mean if they continued to work in Camp Joni, they would hope to escape the oven? The German word for oven was less burden than gas chamber. No, I never told them that. On the other hand, I cannot answer for the practices of my subordinates. I thought it wrong to arouse false hopes. Why false? Because there was a reason for such people to have arrived in the first place at an elimination camp. Some of them were Jews. Sebastian made a note on his pad. How did you know they were Jews? Amadeus seemed surprised by the question. He arrived in a shipload of Jews and most wore identifying marks. Besides, I've had much experience. I can tell just by looking, for instance, that you are part Jewish. Sebastian looked up intrigued and answered, all that you approve by saying that, Herr Amadeus, is that you cannot discern Jewishness. Amadeus shrugged and gave out a tight little smile. He was saying that when the trains arrived in Joni, there were people in the cars who were not Jewish. Yes, that's true. There were such people. But they were in all the cars for a reason. If they were Russians, for instance, they were either prisoners of war or Soviet sympathizers. And there were many who were suspected. Suspected of what? Of cooperating with the Soviets. My job, Lieutenant Reinhardt, was not to try them, but to eliminate them. Did you inquire directly from those who passed through your office into the nature of their offense? Their offense, most of them, was to be Jewish. You considered a part of your duty to inquire why being Jewish meant being an enemy of the Third Reich? Amadeus began to smile, then stopped it abruptly. His tone was earnest. You speak, Lieutenant Reinhardt, as if the case against Jews was only a, what shall I say, peculiarity of the Führer. Of course, that is not the case. It was simply that the Führer had the courage to act on the anti-Semitism of most Europeans. Sebastian decided to go ahead and try something different, something that would be very difficult to do, perhaps impossible for a non-German-speaking interrogator. He said, would you consent to tell me in your own words what it was that brought you to believe the strictures of Hitler, of the Führer, on the matter of the Jews? Amadeus puffed deeply from his cigarette, then stamped it out. Again, he stared hard at Sebastian. I became an officer in the SS. The discipline I accepted was to do as the Führer's subordinates instructed me to do. But I accepted another obligation, a derivative obligation. Do you understand my language? You are manifestly too young to have been in college. Yes, I follow you all right. Which was to do what the Führer said and try to think what he thought. One is a better soldier for doing so. So I was a soldier of the Führer. His orders became my orders, and his thinking, my thinking.
That was William F. Buckley, Jr., reading from his latest novel, Nuremberg, The Reckoning. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, Jamie Kirchick, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, and Sam Sodikson. With help from Darren Manoogian, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. For ongoing coverage of the day's news and to listen to archived On Point programs, check out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBUR.